Deathbed Scenes from Davis W. Clark, The Dying Infidel. Voltaire. It is well known that a celebrated infidel labored through a long life to diffuse the poison of infidelity. In life he was preeminent in guilt, and at death, in misery. He had been accustomed for years to call the adorable Savior the wretch, and to vow that he would crush him. He closed many of his letters to his infidel friends with these words, "Crush the wretch." Yet, such is the detestable meanness as well as wickedness of infidelity, that during these efforts to destroy Christianity, he was accustomed to receive the sacrament and to attend to some other acts of religion that he might be able to deny his infidelity if accused of it. Such was he in hell. But dangerous sickness and approaching death, though they could not soften the hard heart of the hypocrite infidel into real penitence, it did fill it with agony, remorse, and despair. Voltaire had risen in poor, deluded France, high in worldly prosperity and fame, but the Most High appeared to permit him to rise to the pinnacle of glory. He might sink with deeper ruin to the gulfs below, and thus afford a more impressive warning of the effects of his folly and his aim. The following awful description has been given of his last hours. Quote, "It was during Voltaire's last visit to Paris, when his triumph was complete, and he had even feared he should die with glory amidst the acclamations of an infatuated theater, that he was struck by the hand of Providence to make a very different termination of his career. In the midst of his triumph, a violent bleeding raised apprehensions for his life. D'Alembert, Diderot, and Marmontel hastened to support his resolution in his last moments, witnesses to their mutual ignominy as well as to his own. Here let not the historian fear exaggeration. Rage, remorse, reproach, and blasphemy all accompany and characterize the long agony of the dying atheist. His death, the most terrible that is ever recorded to have stricken the impious man, will not be denied by his companions in impiety. Their silence, however much they may wish to deny it, is the least of those corroborative proofs that could be adduced. Not one of them has ever dared to mention any sign given of resolution or tranquility by the premier chief. During a space of 3 months, which elapsed from the time he was crowned in the theater until his decease, such a silence expresses how great their humiliation was in his death. It was on his return from the theater, and in the midst of the toils he was resuming in order to acquire fresh applause, when Voltaire was warned that the long career of his impiety was drawing to an end. In spite of all the infidel philosophers who flocked around him in the first days of his illness, he gave signs of wishing to return to the God he had so often blasphemed. He called for the priest who ministered to him, whom he had sworn to crush under the appellation of the wretch. His danger increasing, he wrote, entreating the Abbé Galtier to visit him. He afterward made a declaration, in which he in fact renounced his infidelity. This declaration was signed by himself and 2 witnesses, one of whom was the Marquis del Villafiel, to whom 11 years before Voltaire was wont to write, quote, "Conceal your march from the enemy and your endeavors to crush the wretch," end quote. Voltaire had permitted this declaration to be carried to the rector of St. Sulpice and to the Archbishop of Paris to know whether it would be sufficient. When the Abbé Galtier returned with the answer, it was impossible for him to gain admittance to the patient. The conspirators had strained every nerve to hinder their chief from consummating his recantation, and every avenue was shut to the priest, whom Voltaire himself had sent for. The demons haunted every access. Rage succeeded to fury, and fury to rage again during the remainder of his life. Then it was that D'Alembert, Diderot, and about 20 others of the conspirators who had beset his apartment never approached him but to witness their own ignominy, and often he would curse them and exclaim, "Retire! It is you that have brought me to my present state. Be gone! I could have done without you all, but you could not exist without me, and what a wretched glory if you procured me." Then would succeed the horrid remembrance of his conspiracy. They could hear him, depraved anguish and dread, alternately supplicating or blaspheming that God whom he had conspired against. And in plaintive accents would he cry out, "Oh, Christ! Oh, Jesus Christ!" And then complain that he was abandoned by God and man. The hand which had traced an ancient writ, the sentence of an impious and reviling king, seemed to trace before his eyes. Crush, then, do crush the wretch. In vain he turned his head away. The time was coming apace when he was to appear before the tribunal of him he had blasphemed, and his physicians, particularly Mr. Tronchin, calling in to administer relief, thunderstruck, retired, declaring the death of the impious man to be terrible indeed. The pride of the conspirators would willingly have suppressed these declarations, but it was in vain. The Mariscal de Richelieu flies from the bedside, declaring it to be a sight too terrible to be sustained, and Mr. Tronchin that the furies of Orestes could give but a faint idea of those of Voltaire. In one of these visits, the doctor found him in the greatest agonies, exclaiming with the utmost horror, "I am abandoned by God and man." He then said, "Doctor, I will give you half of what I am worth, if you will just give me 6 more months to live." The doctor answered, "Sir, I cannot give you 6 weeks. Voltaire replied, "Then I shall go to hell, and you will go with me." And soon after, he expired. Thomas Paine. Horrible is the end of the unrighteous generation. This unhappy man is well known to have been one of the most malignant enemies of Christianity. He was an avowed infidel in principle and an open and profligate in practice. He lived despised by the wise and good, and like many other infidels, died apparently full of dread of the future, though a stranger to that repentance which is unto life. The following account of the concluding scenes of his life is from the pen of Dr. Manley, a respectable physician who attended him in his last illness. Quote, "During the latter part of his life, though his conversation was equivocal, his conduct was singular. He would not be left alone night or day. He not only required to have some person with him, but he must see that he or she was there, and would not allow his curtains to be closed at any time. And if, as it would sometimes unavoidably happen, he was left alone, he would scream and halloo until some person came to him. When relief from pain would admit, he would seem thoughtful and contemplative, his eyes generally closed, and his hands folded on his breast, although he never slept without the assistance of an anodyne. There was something remarkable in his conduct at this time, which comprises about 2 weeks before his death, particularly when we reflect that Thomas Paine was the author of The Age of Reason. He would call out during his paroxysms of distress, without intermission, "Oh, Lord, help me! God, help me! Jesus Christ, help me! oh Lord, help me, and so on, repeating the same expressions without the least variation in a tone that would alarm the house. It was his conduct that induced me to think that he had abandoned his former opinions, and I was more inclined to that belief when I understood from his nurse, who is a very serious, and I believe a pious woman, that he would occasionally inquire, on seeing her engaged with a book, what she was reading, and being answered, and at the same time being asked whether she should read aloud. He assented and would appear to give particular attention. I took occasion during the night of the 5th and 6th of June to test the strength of his opinions respecting revelation. I purposely made him a very late visit. It was a time which seemed to suit my errand. It was midnight. He was in great distress, constantly exclaiming in the words above mentioned, when I addressed him in the following manner, the nurse being present, "Mr. Payne, your opinions by a large portion of the community have been treated with deference. You must be sensible that we are acquainted with your religious opinions as they are given to the world. What then must we think of your present conduct? Why do you call upon Jesus Christ to help you? Do you believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ? Come now, answer me honestly. I want an answer as from the lips of a dying man, for I verily believe that you will not live 24 hours. I waited some time at the end of every question. He did not answer, but ceased to exclaim in the above manner. Again, I addressed him, "Mr. Payne, you have not answered my questions. Will you answer them? Allow me to ask, do you believe?" Or let me qualify the question. Do you wish to believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? After a pause of some moments, he answered, "I have no wish to believe on the subject." And then I left him. He was also visited by a Quaker, who was in the practice of visiting the sick for the purpose of affording them consolation. He said he never saw a man in so much apparent distress. He sat with his elbow on his knee and his head leaning on his hand, and beside him stood a vessel to catch the blood that was oozing from him in 5 different streams, like spider's webs. One from the corner of his mouth, one from each eye, and one from each nostril. This friend endeavored to get him into conversation, but was only answered by horrible looks and dreadful groans. He was also visited by a preacher of the Methodist denomination. His object was, if possible, to get from him the truth in his dying hour in relation to his future prospects with eternity, but all he could get from him in answer to his questions was awful groans, which seemed to unnerve the whole of his system. This man was with him until he drew his last breath, and his immortal spirit had fled. Francis Newport, "The wicked is driven away in his wickedness." Francis Newport, who died in the year 1692, was favored with both a religious and liberal education. After spending 5 years in the university, he was entered in one of the inns of court. Here he fell into the hands of infidels, lost his religious impressions, forsook the paths of virtue, became an avowed infidel, and associated himself with a club of educated but abandoned wretches who met regularly to encourage and confirm each other in wickedness. He continued thus for several years, till habits of dissipation and vice brought on an illness during which his former religious impressions revived with invincible force. The horror of his mind was inexpressible. The sweat poured from his body. In 9 days he was reduced, principally through mental anguish, from a robust state of health to perfect weakness. His expressions and language all the while were the most dreadful that imagination can conceive. Writing to his companions, he said, "Who, alas, can write his own tragedy without tears, or copy out the seal of his own damnation without horror? That there is a God I know, because I constantly feel the effects of his wrath. That there is a hell I am equally certain, having received an earnest of my inheritance there already in my breast." His friends, who had only heard he was distracted, hearing him deliver himself in such terms, were amazed, and began to inquire of those around what made him talk like this. He, hearing them whispering together and imagining the cause, called them all to him and said, "You imagine me melancholy or distracted? I wish I were either, but it is part of my judgment that I am not. No. My apprehension of persons and things is rather more alive and vigorous than it was when I was in perfect health, and it is my curse, because by this I am more sensible of the condition I am fallen into. Would you be informed why I am become a skeleton in just 3 or 4 days? See how then I have despised my Maker, denied my Redeemer. I have joined myself to the atheists and profane, and continued this course under many convictions, till my iniquity was ripe for vengeance, and the just judgment of God overtook me when my security was the greatest, and the checks of my conscience were the least. How idle it is to bid the fire not burn when fuel is administered, and to command the seas to be smooth in the midst of a storm. Such is my case, and what are the comforts of my friends? But I am spent. I can complain no more. Would to God that the cause of my complaining would cease. The cause of my complaining? This renews my grief, and summons up the little strength I have left to complain again, like an expiring blaze before it is extinguished. It is just so with me, but where am I going?" And as he said this, he fainted away and lay in a swoon for a considerable time, but by the help of some spirits he was brought to himself again. My business as a writer calling me away for a day or two, I came again on Thursday morning pretty early. When I came, I inquired of his friends how he spent his time. They told me he had had little company, and his expressions were much shorter, but when he did speak, seemed to have more horror and despair than before. I went to his bedside and asked him how he did. He replied, "Damned and lost forever." I told him the purposes of God were hidden. Perhaps he was punished in this life to fit him for a better one. He answered, "They are not hidden to me, but discovered. And my greatest torment, my punishment here, is for an example to others. Oh, that there was no God, or this God would cease to be. For I am sure he will have no mercy upon me." "Alas," I said, "there is no continuing with our Creator, and therefore avoid such words as may provoke him more." "True," he replied, "there is no contending, I wish there was a possibility of getting above God. That would be a heaven to me. I entreated him not to give way to such blasphemous thoughts, for, here he interrupted me, don't we read in the Revelation of them that blaspheme God because of their pains? I am one of their number. Oh, how do I envy the happiness of Cain and Judas? But I replied, you are yet alive. You do not feel the torments of those that are in hell. He answered, this is either true or false. If it be true, how heavy will those torments be of which I do not yet feel the uttermost? But I know it is false, and that I endure more than the spirits of the damned, for I have the very same tortures upon my spirit that they have, beside those I endure in my body. I believe at the day of judgment, the torments of my mind and body will both together be more intense. But as I now am, no spirit in hell endures what I do. How gladly would I change my condition for hell. How earnestly would I entreat my angry judge to send me there, were I not afraid that out of vengeance he would deny me. Here he closed his eyes a little and began to talk very wildly, every now and then groaning and gnashing his teeth. But soon after opening his eyes, he grew sensible again and felt his own pulse and said, how lazily my minutes go on. When will be the last breath, the last pulse that shall beat my spirit out of this decayed mansion into the desired regions of death and hell? Oh, I find it is just now at hand. And what shall I now say? Am I not afraid again to die? Ah, the forlorn hopes of him that is not God. To go to, nothing to fly to for peace and comfort. Here his speech failed him. We all believe in him to be dying. Went to prayer. We threw him into an agony, and wished though he could not speak, he turned away his face, and made what noise he could to hinder himself from hearing it. Perceiving this, we gave up, as soon as he could speak, which was not till after some time. He said, tigers and monsters, are you also become devils to torment me? And give me a prospect of heaven to make my hell more intolerable? Alas, sir, I said, it is our desire of your happiness that casts us down at the throne of grace. If God denies assistance, who else can give it? If he will not have mercy, where must we go for it? He replied, oh, that is a dart that wounds me. God has become my enemy, and there is none so strong as to deliver me out of his hands. He consigns me over to eternal vengeance, and there is none able to redeem me. Were there such another God as he, who would patronize my cause? Or were I above God, or independent of him? Could I act or dispose of myself as I pleased, then would my horrors cease, and my expectations and designs of my formidable enemies be frustrated. But oh, this cannot be, for I... His voice failed again, and he began to struggle and gasp for breath, which having recovered with a groan dreadful and horrid, as if it had been more than human, he cried out, sufferable pangs of hell and damnation! And then he expired.